If you could receive a prescription from a doctor to take a series of pills and have the perfect brain of a leader, would you? What if I told you that you can take psychological prescriptions and become the leader you dream of being? That's what we're going to explore today. Welcome to the Brain and Brand Show. I'm your host, Timothy Maurice, your behavioral psychology author. And today, I have the privilege of speaking to Mr. Willie Peterson, CEO of multi-billion dollar businesses. He has an extraordinary history in business and he's a professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Business. And as it relates to this conversation, he's the author of Leadership, Time and Tested Prescriptions for Those Who Seek to Lead. Willie, thank you for joining us on the Brain and Brand Show.
My pleasure, Tim. Nice to be on. Thank you.
Absolutely. So I have to tell you, before we get into your prescriptions, I have a fun feature called Inside Your Mind, where I give you 7 light questions, things like coffee or tea, so that the audience can get to know you. Can we go inside your mind, Willie?
Yeah, have a go.
All right, here we go. Number one. Lecturing online or in person?
In person.
A night of ballet or opera?
Ballet.
Number three, going fishing or sailing?
Fish doesn't make me seasick.
Number four, these get really, really tough. And you have to choose one, beer or wine?
Beer.
Number five, you have to put on your Elon Musk hat, Mars or Venus?
Mars.
And number six, if you could have lunch with one of these two gentlemen, Da Vinci or Michelangelo?
Da Vinci.
And finally, you get another lunch date. Lunch with Dr. Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela?
Impossible, but I would say Mandela. Mandela.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much for allowing me to go inside your mind. I know you teach at the Columbia Graduate School of Business, but where are you based now? Where are you living?
In New York City on the Upper East Side of the city.
You're on the Upper East Side. Lovely. Yes. I'm in New York often. Next time I'm there, we can have a coffee or a beer, okay?
I'd love to do that. Yeah, beer, not wine.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there are thousands of leadership books.
Yeah,
but you offer really fascinating insights. And I got to tell you that I turned out a lot of interviews on books on leadership, but yours really, really struck me. But before we dive a little bit deeper, who was the first leader that you knew in retrospect? The first person that you can look back on and go, that was a real leader that influenced my life. And this person could be in your family. It could be someone from a community center, some sort of spiritual leader. Who was your first role model leader?
My father. And I was 6 years old when I imbibed my first lesson on leadership. And here's
really?
The story.
Okay.
When I was 6 years old, it was 1943. It was during the Second World War. The Allies were losing rather badly at that point. And we were living in South Africa in a small town. My father was a station master on the railroads, very humble guy, but he wore a uniform, which I always admired because he looked like an authority figure to me at my young age. Mm. And I had a sister 6 years older than I. And my father decided to volunteer and enlist to join the Allies and fight with them in the war, although there was no conscription in South Africa. So it was a completely voluntary decision on his part to go up north, 6,000 miles away. He would be deployed to some kind of a front that he didn't know in advance. He never knew whether he would come back safely or not. I vaguely recollect some conversations at the dinner table with my mother, where she gently probed him and said, "Why are you doing this? We have a young family. South Africa is not involved in the war. The war is 6,000 miles away." And he gave a very simple answer. He simply said, "Because it's the right thing to do." Now,
Wow.
at the time, of course, I was a bit, confused and a little anxious about the whole situation. Fortunately, he came back safely after the conclusion of the war. But as I grew older, I began to understand the significance of what I learned at that young age, and it's influenced my life and my attitude and my psychology. And that is this, that leadership that makes a difference, it's not just about let's define leadership, that's easy. Let's define leadership that makes a difference. And I think the kind of leadership that makes a difference takes moral courage. And there's a distinction between physical courage, which is like skydiving or helicopter skiing for the thrill of it. There's nothing wrong with that, but you're doing it purely
Sure.
for selfish reasons, and that's fine too. We all have hobbies. It has nothing to do with doing something right that makes a real difference. And so moral courage is the preparedness to stand up and do the right thing, regardless of the circumstances. And that has influenced my thinking throughout my life. Now, we're all
Wow.
imperfect. We all fall short from time to time. But I think that the real trick here is to know what you have fallen short of. And whenever I'm challenged with an issue of moral courage, as I was in 20 years as a CEO, and in daily life, we're all challenged with things like this. If I do this, I might be more unpopular. Maybe people won't like me. Maybe I'll lose power. Maybe it'll threaten my progress in this organization.
Yes.
But the preparedness to stand up for the right thing, regardless of those circumstances, is what real leadership is about. And we should never forget that we're always being role models for others, just like
Yes.
my father did. He didn't make a speech, he just did it, and I watched.
You know what's incredible is when we're done with this call, I'm going to call the White House. I've got some connections at the White House.
Good idea. Good
And
idea.
instead of these presidential candidates doing another debate, I'm going to see if they'll join us on a podcast.
That's
You
good.
know,
So
Willie, I am fascinated by the conviction in your writing. You know, it's one thing to write about leadership theoretically from a research perspective, but it was clear to me that you live this work. You know, I want to go into your classroom at Columbia University's Graduate School of Business. At this stage of your life, I'm sure you could go off and enjoy a beachfront life and just kind of think, retrospect. Why do you do this? Take me into the classroom. What are you enjoying? Why is it that at this stage that you continue to invest your time in this classroom?
I would change just one word there. Not invest my time, but into enjoy it. And that's really
Lovely.
at the heart of it all. I've kind of three mottos, right, informal, that govern my decisions. Number one is never retire.
Okay.
Two is never stop learning. And number three is lead life at a reasonable pace. Now, it's hard to reconcile those three things, but those that determine, what I do, how much of I do of it that I do, and it's really driven by the fulfillment I derive from it. Now, it's an interesting thing. People call me a teacher, I guess. That's my profession as a teacher. Actually, that's a misleading word. The Latin word for educate is educare.
Oh,
The
wow.
translation means to lead out, not to put in. Teaching is not about lecturing and imposing views on others. It's about extracting insight from them through discussion. It's a Socratic method. And I think that's the great part of teaching. which is actually the greatest way ever invented to learn. And if we're an avid learner, get into that game, and then you're learning together. You're unlocking insights together through discussion and probing. And I always tell folks in my classes is let's be hard on issues and soft on people. And then let's really, attract reality here and extract the insights through the Socratic method of questioning and answering and putting people into groups to explore issues, coming up with points of view, cross-fertilizing, challenging each other's thinking, and capturing the insights. Now, I think that's a marvelous thing to do with our lives, is to continue learning that way. And learning is a social activity. So one of the
Got
things
it.
you asked me at the beginning, online or in person. Well, online is kind of okay as a substitute if there's no real good cost-effective alternative. But because it's a social activity, it requires interaction, it requires a level of trust and understanding and getting to know each other and tuning in and showing respect for the views of others. Learning how to listen, which is a huge part of learning. If you don't know how to listen attentively and with respect and with a desire to understand, you'll never learn anything.
How many years?
So,
How many years have you been teaching at the school?
27 years.
Really?
It's my third career. I started off as a lawyer in Cape Town. Then I became a corporate executive and was a CEO of various companies in various countries for 20 years. And now I've been a teacher and professor of the practice of management at Columbia Business School for 27 years. Now, I say that because I've been darned lucky. I've had a wonderful learning laboratory that I can learn from all of these experiences and from working and living in these different cultures, working in different industries. I do a lot of consulting work with organizations across the spectrum, some of them not-for-profit organizations, some of them commercial, and in different industrial segments. So, boy, isn't that a wonderful kaleidoscope of experiences to learn from, extract insights from? And I've had the privilege, of course, of working with CEOs from those various enterprises who've taught me a lot. We learn from observation, we learn from reading, and we learn from what we call teaching, the classroom experience.
Yes. Yeah. That value chain that you've sort of experienced in your life is, it's a dream model for me, I have to tell you. As I'm listening to you, I'm like, wow. I mean, that is like my dream life to be able I mean, I do similar work, but it's one of those things where recently I've been thinking about that laboratory and, I'll have a separate conversation with you offline about this, but I do want to go back into the book now. When you look at the field of how we adapt and evolve, what's popularly known as evolutionary psychology and evolutionary biology, you believe there is a link between evolution and leadership. Unpack that for us.
A very strong link. In fact, if we break that link, we're in trouble. Now, by the way, the title of my book, just to clarify it, is Leadership, the Inside Story. And
The
then
inside story, yes.
prescriptions for those who seek to lead. Evolution and business, evolution and life, basically is where we begin. Now, Charles Darwin wrote this fantastic book in 1859 that in many ways turned the world upside down in terms of the way we think about how humans evolved and how we continue to adapt. And there is a set of rules. Now, the interesting thing about life or leading organizations is that sometimes we have freedom of choice. At other times, we're bound by laws that we can't change. Law like gravity. I can't throw a ball in the air and say my choice is for it to remain up there. It won't remain up there. It'll fall down
Yes.
for the law. Okay. Gravity and evolution, I'm sorry. Evolution is the same thing. It's a law. It's not a choice. Now, what does this law tell us? The scientific fact of it is that the only way for a species of any kind, biological species, to survive is to constantly adapt and change to the changing external environment. And those who are unable to adapt cannot survive. 99% of the species that have ever existed are now extinct. So that's how harsh this law is. Now, in nature, this is a blind, arbitrary process. You either generate a favorable variation as a tree or a plant or an animal, and it's a kind of a lottery. If it's a favorable variation, you'll survive and pass those survival genes on to your progeny. If you're unlucky, you're out of the game. Now, the same rules apply for organizations, except for we have one advantage that nature doesn't have. That's the advantage that we're able to learn as sentient human beings. I think the biggest responsibility for any leader is to safeguard the sustainability of the organization, to make sure that it has a future, not just a short-term present. Do you know that the survival rate of organizations on the global S&P 500 is about half of a human life?
Wow.
Now, the bell curve, I mean, some have lasted very long, some last a very short term, but that's about 45 years. It's about half of what humans are. That's not a good record. So I think if we go and look at the evidence, which I always like to do, let's make our prescriptions in leadership evidence-based, not just, oh, I experienced this and I think it's a good idea. Because I think it's a good idea, I'm going to impose it on you. I want you to adopt it. It's not like that. Let's look at the evidence. And what the evidence shows is that organizations unable to adapt to a changing environment, and I've got examples if you would like them, end up not able to survive. Even the largest and apparently the most successful ones in the world at any given moment confront this issue of a changing world. Now, the issue is the world will not stop changing. Therefore, we dare not stop learning. So the only means of survival into the longer term is to keep learning and adapting. So if you look at organizations and ask yourself, you know, what is the determinant of how long it lives? The answer is it's not a factor of its age. It's a factor of its adaptive capacity. And that adaptive capacity comes from the ability to learn and adapt. And we need hardwired practical processes that are shared throughout the organization in order to do that. And that's why I specifically designed a process called strategic learning that involves these four steps of learning and adaptation.
Let's go through the first few of those steps.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so the four steps are learn, focus, and then the next two are align and then execute. So it starts with the learn step. Now, that's our intelligence system. Just like a nation needs to have an intelligence system, an army, a military needs to have an intelligence system that guides, that creates insights into the external environment and guides our thinking in terms of what should happen in order to survive. That's where it all starts, all right? So I've got a technique for that called a situation analysis involving how we explore the external environment and our own realities and look at the misfits between what our capabilities are and what the external environment expects of us in order to succeed. So here's the key. It's an outside-in process of learning because success happens outside the boundaries of our organization, not inside. Inside's where we count the money. Outside is where we compete for success. All right. So first look out of the window, then look in the mirror. All right. That's the kind of thing.
Yes.
Okay. Very simple. Now the next step is focus.
Okay.
Here's the determinant of focusing effectively. There's only one reason why you need to have a strategy, and that's because of the reality of limited resources. If you had unlimited resources, you wouldn't need a strategy, you wouldn't need to make choices, you wouldn't worry about risk, and competitors would be irrelevant. You just throw resources at your problems all day long, and you would last forever. That's a fantasy. It doesn't exist. Now, because you have limited resources, it forces you to make choices in what is now a zero-sum game. That's what limited resources imposes on you. Every additional thing you do subtracts energy and effort from everything else you do. It's a law. I didn't just not just my opinion. So that forces you to make these choices. That's step two, focus. And it's informed by the situation analysis, so it's not just guesswork.
Got
And
it.
the choices you have to make are just three. Where will we compete? How will we win? And what will be our key priorities for success? If you don't have clear answers to those three questions, you don't have a strategy. And to inform those three questions, the answers to the three questions, you need to do a great situation analysis first. So that's a rough and ready description of the first two steps.
Beautiful. Let me just say this. I mean, part of the magic of me being able to learn in these conversations is that, I've got 10 years of podcasting that, this conversation is timeless. So this being the 10th year of my podcast, I just want to take a moment to say thank you for coming on and contributing to this extraordinary library of conversations. Unlike a news outlet that has these fleeting conversations that just sort of pass by, what you're sharing is timeless. And I'm so grateful. So I'm having a moment of gratitude right now, Willie. So thank you very much for allowing me to have this commercial break.
It's mutual. It's mutual. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's,
That's right.
yeah. I want to talk a little bit about. I want to shift from the model a bit because people are going to get this book and they're going to read it. But I want to shift a little bit to talk about the silent forces, silent behaviors that influence leadership. You touched on this, and I find it compelling. And I'd like for you to share with the audience a little bit about those silent forces.
Something that we forget about leadership when we're in that position of leadership. And by the way, leadership is not about power, it's about service. It's not just about making great decisions. It's really driven by a set of principles, underlying principles that govern our behavior, like moral courage that I mentioned at the beginning. But a set of governing principles that guide our behavior and inspire others. And I think all great leaders have and are driven by that clear set of principles, like Nelson Mandela, as we mentioned at the start. Now, one of the things that we as leaders need to understand is that everybody's watching, and everything we do has got symbolic fallout. It has an effect on the perceptions and the behaviors of others. Now, we always think that leadership is about expressing your principles, and that's fine. Communicating them is fine, but they need to be transparent through your behavior. Now,
Yes.
it's some at a very simple level. If you walk into the office in the mornings with a spring in your step and a smile and a nice, cheerful hello, that lifts the mood of everybody else. If you walk in all hunched over and looking depressed, etc., that depresses others. It's infectious. People are watching.
Yes.
Everything has symbolic fallout. Now, I'll give you one just, there are a number of examples I'd like to offer this because it's a very important thing. By the way, let me just quote somebody here.
Okay.
And that is Ralph Waldo Emerson, an American philosopher from the
Yeah.
last century. And he captured this idea very well when he said, what you do speaks so loudly that I cannot hear what you say. So the integration between your words and your deeds is everything in terms of leadership that makes a difference. Now, here's my little story. I was head of Seagram USA, which was at the time the largest liquor company in the United States. We had a conference of senior regional leaders, and then one evening we had a social event. Just to enjoy each other's company, etc. And one executive, and let's call him Andre, great enthusiast for what he did, somebody full of ideas that he wanted to impart to me, literally cornered me. I was in a corner and he was standing facing me, right? And he said, I'm going to offer you some thoughts. And he went on, and they were very good ideas. And I wanted to say to him, Andre, when are you flying back? Because, let's meet in my office and let's go into the. No, let me just tell you now. And the time was going on, and I was very aware of the fact that I needed to circulate with others, etc. And but I was trapped. I didn't want to be rude to Andre, but the moment came eventually when I said, Andre, I really just have to circulate. I hope you understand, but let's schedule something. These are fascinating ideas. I'd like to explore them more deeply. And he said, oh, fine, just one more thing, he said. Eventually I escaped and circulated and everything was fine. Very enjoyable social event. The next morning I walked into my office and my assistant, Joanne, said to me, oh, how did you enjoy the reception last night? And I said, well, I think it was terrific, exchanging ideas with people. She said, well, you want to know what the buzz is, what people are saying? I said, yeah, what are they saying? She said, they're saying that Andre is your favorite. I said, Andre is my favorite? Where does that come from? And she said, well, they say you spent most of the evening speaking to Andre.
Wow.
That was the symbolic fallout. The way you spend your time, with whom you spend your time,
Wow.
everybody notices. When you spend time with somebody, you're showing that you value them. When you
Yes.
spend more time with them, you're saying, I value you more. Now, whether you want to spend the time or not, that's the symbolic fallout. And I looked at that and I realized in a very stark way for the first time how very real that symbolism is. And you need to deliberately create the right kind of symbolism that has this fallout that is productive, informative, uplifting, inspiring.
Incredible. When you're thinking about being mindful and preparing yourself so that you can be organically, naturally aware, you gear your mind so that you don't have to think about, like, oh, who am I spending time with? You could almost operate in a stealth-like naturalness, right? Where you're just being yourself because you've geared your mind. You explore in, you explore in the book about powerful ways of self-regulating to not only stay present, but also for discoveries. You talk about how some of the greatest leaders have had breakthrough discoveries because of things like taking a walk. Why is this so effective?
This thing of being yourself is huge, right? It's called authenticity.
Yeah.
People, inauthenticity shows up in about 30 seconds if you're a pretender. It really does.
Yeah.
But authenticity doesn't just drop out of the blue sky. It's a part of the way you build your own character. And I think authenticity comes from being intentional. It starts with describing for yourself who you are and what you believe in. You need to write it down. I mean, things like moral courage, things like respect for others, protecting the human dignity of all around you, et cetera, and then live those because they're you. They're not, you're not borrowing somebody else's. They're you.
Yes,
And you can't
yes,
be everything. You've got to be very
yes.
clear about what you are and what defines who you are. And because that governs your behavior, makes you consistent. So I think that that idea of being yourself is not just a freewheeling thing of doing what the hell you like. If you want to pee in the street, go ahead and do that because you're being yourself. So I don't think it's that kind of open-ended. I think it comes from an intentional and
Yes.
deliberate way of thinking. That's why I call this book The Inside Story, because that's how it begins. That's where leadership starts. Now, taking a walk. Well, this was an accidental discovery. I'm a learner. I love to read. I don't read many business books. I do read some. I read mainly about evolutionary science, philosophy, and astrophysics. Those
Oh,
are the
wow.
items that inform my thinking. Philosophy for me, and why I love philosophy, is that it answers three big questions for us in life. It helps us discover more clearly what's true, what's important, and what's right. And I
Wow.
honestly think most of our dilemmas involve going through a process of saying, well, what's true here? And what's really not true that I can rely on? What's the truth? Truth is very difficult sometimes because it's an interpretive skill to understand the truth. It's not just the data, it's what the data tells you. And the second is, of all that's true, what's really important here in making a decision? And finally, what's right? Now, between right and wrong, it's so obvious that our teenage kids can do that. The big challenge is choosing between right and right. And then we go back to what's important. So those three things are always there and as we explore philosophy. So I'm always reading something and then thinking about it. I keep a learning journal. I write down my insights so that I can clarify them and retrieve them regularly. Then I made a discovery. This brings us to walking. I developed a habit as a CEO every day to walk 2 miles before work began. I really enjoyed work walking through Central Park. I'd mapped out a half an hour walk. I knew that, I walk 15 miles an hour, that at least a mile every 15 minutes, not 15 miles an hour. And I knew this was a 2 mile walk. So I did that, almost religiously. I corporate days as a CEO, I had a driver. He was a bit of a, he used to nanny me a little bit because he dropped me off on one side of Central Park. I'd put my sneakers on, walk through, he'd pick me up on the other side. And every time it was cold or windy or something, he'd say, "It's a little windy today, sir. Shall we just go straight to work?" And I said, "Joe, the only weather I do not walk in is rain. Snow's okay and everything keeps me dry. Every other thing, we just walk." All right. Now, here's what I discovered. That during those walks, ideas came into my mind, typically where I had been wrestling with a problem or thinking deeply about something I'd read about. And an insight would come into my mind, unbidden, uninvited. Or it could be something that we'd been struggling with as a decision at work. There was a tough decision I'd been discussing with my team. And we said, well, let's put this aside and kind of sleep on it. And I walked through the park and suddenly, wham, an insight will come and say, that's the breakthrough in thinking. Now, Joanne, my assistant, who I mentioned earlier, would know when I walked into the office, first thing I did is walk straight in, write down what I'd thought about in my walk, and then say good morning. And she realized I wasn't being rude, but I'd write it down. I was so fascinated by this that I looked for evidence as to whether, well, first of all, what was the underlying reason why this happened? And for evidence to see whether it's a general rule or a Peterson kind of idiosyncrasy.
Effect. Yeah.
It's a general rule, is when you've been struggling with an issue, the key is don't keep hammering. Withdraw from that, do something different, whether it's the ballet or walking or going for a swim or whatever it is, free your mind from it, and I promise you, ideas will come. Now, there's plenty of evidence. I put it in my book. Remarkable breakthroughs. I'll give you just one example. We take electricity for granted today. It was a huge struggle to find the right way to generate and transmit electricity. Now, Thomas Edison was the first one to do the breakthrough, but he developed what we call direct current. And the problem with direct current is you need, or it only goes a short distance. Now, if you lit up the southern part of Manhattan, everybody said, wow, fantastic. Now, let's have more of that. You have to have numerous substations to keep generating and regenerating. It's a very, very expensive way to do it. So we couldn't do it long distances. A scientist who was a bit of a madcap, actually, a guy called Nikola Tesla, he struggled
Yes.
to solve the problem. People thought he was a bit nuts, and maybe he was, but he was brilliant. He struggled and struggled, and he got people to donate, to his research, and he failed. And eventually he left the United States somewhat as a kind of, a comical figure, a little bit in disgrace. He was going for a walk in a park in Budapest when the idea of alternating current flew into his head. And he designed it. And we now have an electricity generating system based on a breakthrough from Nikola Tesla in a park in Budapest. It came during a walk. And now we talk about steam engines. And the guy, and he's named, it doesn't come to me right away, but he struggled with it. You know, the original steam engine was designed to remove water from coal mines. It weighed about 25 tons. And it was at Thomas Watt, I can't remember now, you might remember the name, who invented the steam engine. And he looked at this machine and said, well, that's enormously powerful. It was used in manufacturing processes, et cetera. He said, what about locomotion? We need, if this was put into an engine that could pull a train on some rails, you know, hugely imaginative way of thinking about it, but you can't do it if it weighs 25 tons. And he went for a walk one Sunday afternoon, which was his habit. And he literally says, as I passed the Hurd's house, Hurd's, H-U-R-D-S, was a kind of a neighbor. As I went around the corner past the house that belonging to Mr. and Mrs. Hurd, the idea of a steam engine flew into my head. And I rushed down home and wrote it down. And that was the invention of the railroad system.
Wow.
So, you know, we get,
incredible.
Forget about these. And I've got a whole list of these in my book.
Yes, yes.
And so I often, I mean, one, I remember one consulting project I did. We had, you know, problems that were, for this company, sort of grotesquely difficult and complicated. And after a day of doing this and wrestling with it, I said, I tell you what, let's go bowling tonight. And the CEO said, well, they must continue working. I said, you know, this would be playful work. Just believe me, we go bowling. So we made an appointment at a bowling alley. And we went bowling and we laughed and we had fun. And, you know, the next morning we got together again. And by the way, the breakthroughs came thick and fast.
Wow.
I said to them, do you think we would have had these breakthroughs if we didn't go off and have some fun and disengage our minds from this kind of intense thinking? And they said,
no.
Oh, this is a great idea. The CEO said to me, every time I now have a workshop, we're going to go bowling. Yeah, so it's the same general principle.
Yeah, it's incredible how, you know, so much of the thinking part of the brain shuts down to unleash all of those unconscious patterns of genius in our minds, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, what I hope people take for this conversation is the need to go into the mirror and really slow down. And the level of gravity and depth in this book is extraordinary. And we could spend literally 3 hours, and I could listen to you. This is probably, I enjoy, you know, one of the things I enjoy about my podcast is the ability to engage. But every so often, it's probably the third time in 3 years where I'm just really enjoying shutting up and allowing you to go. And I wish we could do it the whole night. I want to close by, you know, I want you to give me one of the characteristics to help someone earn trust. And the reason I want to close on this is because I don't care if you're an architect, a teacher, marketer, a president. If you cannot earn trust, you cannot move projects. You cannot move entities forward. And so I want to close. I want you to give me one of your favorite. I know you can, but they must be like children, these five characteristics to earn trust, but give us one and then they can read the rest in the book.
Yeah, it's a very important question. You know, trust lies at the basis of all effective leadership, of all productive relationships between human beings. You can't be a friend of somebody if they don't trust you, if there's not mutual trust. It's a foundation pretty well of everything. All sound and enduring relationships are based on trust. So I thought deeply about it because a company I was consulting with had the strategy of being a trusted advisor. And so I said to them, in your mind, how does trust show up? If you want to be a trusted advisor, you must be specific. And as a team, collectively and consistently, develop that ability to be a trusted advisor. So others must trust you. You can't ask them to trust you. I mean, the worst thing in the world is to start off by saying, trust me. People say, why the hell must I do that? I don't owe you any favors. So, how does it begin? What are the actual factors that drive a trusting relationship? And I lay them out because I looked at this and I looked for evidence again, as I always do. And number one in issues of trust is I understand your needs. Seek first to understand before being understood. In every relationship that you start with, consulting relationship, listen first, then speak. Tell me
Wow.
about your needs. Tell me
Yes.
what's important to you. Tell me what success looks like. Tell me what I can do for you along those lines. So it's demonstrating and listening productively in that kind of way and showing that you truly understand people's needs. But the second one then builds on that, and which is, I have the skills to solve your problem. If you don't have the skills to solve somebody's problem, they can't possibly trust you. And be honest about it. If you say, yeah, I can, my team can do this for you. Or alternatively, I don't think we've got the skills or competencies to give you what you need. I'll help you find somebody to do that. Now, by the way, you think that's a way of losing business? No, it's a way of gaining business. Just look at what happens in the future when you do that kind of thing. So, those are two of them that are really, really important. And
Thank
one other
you.
I just point out, if I might,
Yes.
be a truth teller. The moment you start to dress things up and really kind of hedge on the truth, people detect that very, very quickly. Even if
Yeah.
it's bad news,
Yeah.
you really need to be able to deliver it and be honest about it.
Yes.
So, and those are three of the five that I laid out.
Really, yeah, I'm just thinking, I mentioned earlier that we need these politicians to join us on this podcast so we can grow through these five characteristics. I mean, I am blown away by this new era of just spin, where the better spinner you are, this seems to be you seem to get ahead for a short period. But I think, as you said earlier, your ability to be authentic is the only sustainable way. You can spend for a few days, but eventually you're going to be found out. I really, really, really appreciate it. And I'm going to take you up on that offer. The next time I'm in New York, I'm going to reach out to you. So maybe we can go for a walk and let's
Yes.
see what we can discover together. Willie Peterson, thank you so much for joining me on the Brain and Brand Show.
Tim, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.